Well, it's good to have you back, Barry, and since I guess I haven't seen you since Arctic Dreams, congratulations on the American
Thank
Book
you.
Award. A little
Thank
late.
You. That's all right. I appreciate it.
I mentioned that was, were you here in town for the award?
Yes, it was at the Waldorf Astoria. We didn't know until that night, and so all the nominees were there.
I think I was there. Who else won that? Do you remember who else won?
Doctorow.
Yeah. I was there.
I
interviewed most out in the hallway. I think I interviewed the winners.
You could have. I was a little stunned, so I might not have remembered. But I remember it was quite a... I remember going out into the hall in front of the elevators from the dining room to call Sandy to tell her that Arctic Dreams had won, and I was holding the telephone like this at the... I was standing in front of the telephone holding it, waiting for Sandy to answer, and I looked like that, and there were six people standing there taking a photograph, and I thought, your life has changed. They're photographing, taking a phone call. And then there was a photograph in PW the next week or something like that, that I was phoning my wife, and I thought, wait a minute.
Did it change your life?
The award?
Mm-hmm.
It just turned on a big spotlight that I was... grateful to have, and as soon as I was able, stepped away from, so that I could go on working. You know, and,
well, most I've talked to a lot of winners, Nobel winners, Pulitzer Prize winners. Most of them say that after the initial euphoria and excitement, their lives generally get back to normal. The telephone stops ringing, and they get back to the job of writing.
Yeah.
It's nice to be judged positively by your peers, though, isn't it?
It is, and then I have. Some people are very cynical about it, and you know, there was that big turmoil when Larry Heineman won for Paco's Story, and Toni Morrison didn't win, and everybody got their nose out of joint about that, and a lot of cynical things were said about the National Book Awards. And I was glad to be here. I was deeply honored, and. I'm glad to have Louise Nevelson's sculpture sitting in my room, and my work goes on. And
I remember very you were brought to tears. When you got up to
when
speak.
When I spoke, yes, I was.
That's
well,
right.
I'm very moved by the traditions of this industry. There are extraordinary people working in it in selfless ways for not very much money, to make sure that good books get into the hands of people who need them. If you talked about the evolution of a literature of hope at the end of the 20th century in North America, in fiction and nonfiction, which I would like to think we can talk about that kind of thing, then it would bring tears to your eyes to know that people working in these difficult situations in New York with the traffic and the way the city works and everything have given their whole lives to that. And it's not their names that end up on the National Book Award. It's not their names that end up in prominent places in the newspapers or something like that. So it's proper to stand up in a moment and say what everybody knows is true anyway, that nobody ever gets there alone.
You have such a wealth of material and experience out in the wilderness. Why haven't you used this to write a fiction?
I have.
Oh, yeah.
I've been writing collections of short stories all along,
but I'm thinking
large scale.
You haven't written a novel.
No. But in my own slow and stumbling way, the next book to come out will be a novella. Mm-hmm. So that's a little bit larger stride than the short story. I feel such a strong sense of social responsibility as a writer. That the easiest way conceptually for me to deal with that is in nonfiction. I mean, it makes sense to me that I would go to a place in which people or landscape or animals were imperiled and try to write about it in such a way that the reader could say, I see what's there, and then on their own decide what they were going to do about it. Fiction is a somewhat different and more complex thing to me. But I've noticed in the past few years that I'm going back and looking at things that are really that I would develop in no other way than in fiction. So I suspect that the book that I'm working on now is a large nonfiction book that's and it's involved a great deal of travel, mostly in Africa and in the Galapagos Islands and in Antarctica and in the Northern Territory in Australia. And I'm going back and forth to those places on a more or less regular basis, trying to work with the structure of this book. But I suspect that as I begin to understand that, I will be writing more and more fiction. Because I think probably I can't work some of the things that are on my mind as a writer out, always in that nonfiction form. And I would like to try to work them out, some of them in fiction.
A presentation in Wales was a wonderful, wonderful essay. And there was material there for fiction. You could easily have reconstructed dialogue and
had
heroes in here, you had villains.
Oh, yes. Oh, it's a wonderful allegory about, it's a story where these 41 sperm whales come up on the coast of Oregon and lay there and died for 2 days. And I stood there for 4 days and watched what people did. And you saw the best and the worst of what human beings are capable of. I had actually, I remember one time when I was in on a small island in Bering Sea, and was a very tense racial situation, and a decision was made that even though I was white, I was going to be allowed to stay. And in some sense, the story that I was able to do hinged on that. But because it was a nonfiction story, and because it is my belief that the writer never turns up in a situation like that unless there's very good reason, that what you do is of not really of any interest to the reader unless it's pertinent to the story. The story always comes first. I could find no way that didn't seem self-serving to say how I got to say there. So I just left it out. And the editor that I was working with said, well, it's not going to be lost. You can always use it in a piece of fiction. And I had never in my life understood fiction that way. I had always thought of fiction as something that you had to make up entirely. You don't write about your friends' lives in some thinly disguised way, write about your own life. I thought that was kind of cheating. I thought that you should make it all up, the plot and the people. I mean, you draw on the things that are your experience. But as I get older, I think probably it's okay to use some things that you've experienced, that the range of the human imagination is not such that you can imagine everything. But I realize now, especially because of this traveling that I've been doing in northern Japan, as well as these other places that I've spoken of, even China, and that I have been privileged because of my work to see an enormous part of the surface of the earth and many different peoples, and have had the goodwill and the wisdom and the strangeness of other people extended to me. And it is rich ground for fiction. So maybe when I break down and can't physically travel anymore.
just apropos of what you said, I want to talk about some of the essays in Crossing Open Ground, but I just wanted to tell you a little anecdote. Several years ago, quite a few years ago, I read a book by Sloan Wilson who wrote The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit. I believe it was called A Sense of Values. And it was about a writer who breaks up with his wife after having a successful book published and moves to New York. And it was not a bad book. I remember there was one scene in which he was crossing the street near Carnegie Hall and he was almost hit by a car, and the car begins honking, and he takes his attaché case and hits the fender of this car. Well, many years later, I picked up a nonfiction book by Sloan Wilson. It was called The Return of the Man in the Gray Flannel Suit or something, but it was an autobiography.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
And I began reading it, and I said, no, this is a brand new book, but I've read this before. I swear. And then I got to the part where he was crossing the street near Carnegie Hall, and he was so furious at being honked at, he hit the car. I happened to have this book, Sense of Values, and I got the book out, and it was almost word by word the same as his autobiography. I mean, this was supposed to be a fiction, but I swear to God, you didn't have to read the new book. You could have read the old one. It told you the same. Only the names had been made up, you know.
You know, I think that one of the interesting distinctions that's made between fiction and nonfiction is not spoken enough often, is not spoken about often enough, and that is that there's a serious set of obligations here a serious agreement that has to be worked out with the reader. A reader in fiction or nonfiction has to understand quickly what is the nature of our relationship, which means what is the nature of the authority that I will extend to you as a writer. And it's different in fiction from what it is in nonfiction. And my sense about those two different ways of approaching reality is that that you have a different way of establishing a trust, your trust, the reader's trust. You have a different way of establishing grounds for trust with the reader. And I'm, I guess, occasionally disturbed by the idea that it's all, that the distinctions between fiction and nonfiction have to do with the way in which factual material is handled. I think you're better off saying that it's the nature of the agreement that you work out in the form with the reader, so that the reader knows, is what you're talking verifiable in a world other than yours and the world that I now occupy with you at the moment? Is this true enough for me to vote by, for example? If you're writing a work of nonfiction, you have to be aware of that. And I think part that the reader has to bring something to nonfiction, and that is to recognize that every one of us is fallible. And no matter how you try as a writer to live up to that sense of community responsibility by saying as well as you can, in as organized a fashion as you can, what happened, that you're always going to miss something. You're always going to be the victim of your own ignorance and your own bias and your own mistakes. And the reader, I think, is looking for a situation where they can have a sense of trust deep enough so that when they come across a mistake that they know to be a factual error, their attitude is, oh, well, I could have done the same thing myself, and read right on. But if you run up against a nonfiction work in which the author pretends at the beginning that he or she knows all there is to know or has all the answers or something like that, you're going to be critical about the small mistakes because no one can abide that kind of arrogance. It's not...
Well, I have to tell you something. Last year I published a novel. It was a thriller centered around H.L. Mencken. And every week or two I get a letter. I got a scurrilous letter last week because there was a grammatical error which was stated by Mencken in the book. It was a very minor grammatical error, but the reader was furious because he knew that Mencken would never have made that mistake. Almost all of the letters I received were complimentary, but every one of the letters found a flaw. For example, one reader caught a misspelling, Kremel hair oil, which was a hair oil back in the 1940s. Apparently that was misspelled.
Oh, no.
It took the time to write me to say, another reader, I had Mencken traveling from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania to New York via Paterson, New Jersey, and one reader wrote me to say that it was impossible. No trains went through Paterson, New Jersey from Bethlehem. Although I got this from Mencken's memoirs, and on and on and on. So even though this was a fiction, people caught errors in it, or presumed errors, and were concerned enough to write. So you don't let the fiction writer off the hook if he makes a mistake.
No, and I would say, I remember one time being with a group of students who it was a young student who had written a story set in Ely, Minnesota. And he described Ely, Minnesota in such a way that I knew that he'd never been to Ely, Minnesota. And so I said in the gentlest way possible that there is this issue of verisimilitude. You have to establish, if you're going to say Ely, Minnesota, then the reason people say write about what you know about is because it's not just you're going to make an error, it's you're going to create something that has a pattern that's not, it's not trustworthy, it's not solid ground. And he said to me, well, the only reason that you say that is because you started out and you've written, he said, you are a journalist, you write nonfiction, that's why you say this. And I was too kind, and I was irritated by the remark, I was too kind to just get up and write Gabriel Garcia Marquez across the board and sit down. You know, the notion that because you're a journalist is the only reason that you care for accuracy is to misunderstand what's necessary in fiction as well as nonfiction, and that is you must show a respect for the material. The reader wants... If you're not going to give the reader the kind of a tour de force of a kind of pyrotechnic act of imagination, then you've got to build some ground on which the reader can walk around, whether it's fiction or nonfiction. And there will always be, I think, the reader who is going to know more factual material, that is going to know the train schedules, you know, going through Patterson or something like that.
Yes. I read several years ago, I read a thriller written by someone who did not live in New York, and he had all sorts of errors in streets and subways and buildings. And to me, the book lost its credibility.
Yes.
I didn't trust the book.
Yes.
There was one writer, he was a Canadian, and he kept referring to various embassies here in New York. Now, he meant to say missions to the United Nations. He, mm-hmm. The embassies are always in capitals.
Yes.
You know, in Washington is where we find the embassy.
Yes.
And he made that error, and it all through the book, he had people holed up in the Soviet embassy in New York.
Yes.
And as a result, I didn't trust his book. I mean, if he had erred there, there were other errors that I didn't catch. But anyway, we're going off on tangents. Let's talk about Crossing Open Ground. This is a book of essays that's now out in paperback, and I'd like for you to tell me about some of the... Well, let's talk about the presentation in Wales. This was really one of the most interesting essays there. There were all these whales stranded, and you actually went there and saw what was going on. It was really a circus, wasn't it? A carnival.
Yes, well, carnival is a good word for it. This was something that occurred in June of 1979, and I had actually just that day come back from Alaska and had been up for 24 hours and was a little confused in my own way of trying to figure out which was day and which was night, because I'd been living, the sun had been up 24 hours a day, and we'd just been working on a schedule that we made up. So I was a little temporally disoriented. But I as soon as I heard that this had happened, I thought, my goodness, this is 100 miles from my home. There's 41 sperm whales have come ashore on the coast, and whatever is going to happen is going to be extraordinary. So I went over there and spent a period of time on the beach interviewing people and standing by the whales and watching them, and then I came in the wake of that incident, came back a week later and talked to the police and the scientists who'd been involved, and to a number of people who were there as reporters and that sort of thing. And I had no point to make, I guess. I don't think I've ever gone into an essay where I had some point that I felt I wanted to make.
But the behavior of the spectators was terrible.
Well, yes, it is terrible, but it's always been that way, and it'll be that way tomorrow as well. I mean, there were a group of people, some of whom were drunk, who stood at the sides of these whales and carved their initials in their sides while the animals were still alive. There were people running up and down with their dogs on top of these whales while they were dying. And the other side of it was, I remember, a woman who knelt at the head of this whale in the sand, and she was, to these, I think, very insecure and drunken men, she was an object of derision, but it was because they were so profoundly insecure and didn't know what else to do except to shout and punch each other and stab the whales with their penknives. And this young woman knelt at the head of this animal and prayed. And her act of generosity and integrity intimidated, I think, most of the people that were around her, because they didn't have the courage to do what she did, which was to publicly say, I grieve the loss of this that I don't understand, that we call Physeter catadon, or the sperm whale. I grieve this loss. And that, to me, was as important a thing as I saw in all the 4 days that I was there on the beach. I think what I'm trying to do in an essay like this is, it's easy to point out the barbarians. It's easy to, for the most part, to find somebody to blame. But that doesn't get us very far. We have to understand what our predicament is. And I think what was going on that beach at that time, certainly I think it'd be foolish to say that the animals planned this or something like this. We saw a part of the world that we don't understand, which is these huge animals. These animals are the size of railroad boxcars, came ashore on the beach and died there. They're mammals. They're like us. Their physiological processes are like us. They nurse their young. So they're very close relatives in a sense. And no one could do anything. You couldn't drag them off the beach into the water. You couldn't make them not die. And that lesson was driven home. And so then all of these people had to deal with the fact that they were going to be dead, and then what were you going to do? And the size of the thing was something that no one could really get the grasp of. And there were veterinarians there that you knew how to euthanize large dogs or horses, but nobody had any idea how to euthanize a whale. Where do you begin? How much do you use? I mean, it was impossible. When they were performing necropsies, or what we call an autopsy, I guess, on the whales, there were men in hip boots wandering around in the abdominal cavities of these animals asking each other, where's the liver? It was like walking around in a small pond asking where the frogs are that are there underwater. And it was because their animals are so large. And the bureaucracies were there, people who said, this is a health menace and who's going to pay for it and on, all of that kind of tedious voice of bureaucratic organizations wondering how to make sure that you in particular aren't going to be blamed if somebody gets sick, or, you know, all those kinds of people were there. And the question that I ended up posing at the end was that in order to control the crowds and in order to satisfy the public health officials, the police decided to build a barricade around these animals and allow no one to come past that barricade but the scientists and people like myself who were reporters and members of the media. And I couldn't get over the fact that if there had been a scholar of Melville, if anybody had bothered to find the scholar of Melville, he wouldn't have been allowed to go past the barrier. No rabbi, no priest, no theologian, no dancer, no novelist, all of the people that we turn to in times of personal and community and national stress and say, what are the answers to our predicaments? None of those people were allowed access to this extraordinary event. And I came away thinking, that's what's peculiar about this to me. The fact that they died is a part of life and death. The fact that drunken men carve their initials in the sides of these animals, to say that this should never happen is to say that there will never be another Noriega, there will never be another Papa Doc, there will never be another Idi Amin. These people are going to be with us until, I would think, until the world is finished. What we have to do is find a way to build a society in which they don't take up as much room as they do. And one of the ways to do that is to say, when catastrophic event occurs or when momentous decisions are made, let's get the best range of minds of men and women that we can to bear witness to this, because no one knows where wisdom is going to come from. In all the traveling that I've done with cultures other than my own, with Ainu people in Hokkaido in northern Japan, or with Inuit people in Alaska, with Basawara people in the Kalahari Desert, with Pintanjanyara people in Australia, I have been taught anytime I was on the verge of making the mistake that real wisdom, I don't mean sophisticated sleight of hand that you can see on Wall Street or something like that, but real wisdom about how to behave in the world can come from places that you would never recognize, in languages that you don't speak, in terms of cultural heritages that you disparage or consider primitive. And you'd have to be blind today in the United States to think that we don't have... There's dark water below the surface here in this country. Everybody sees it from a different angle, but we know it's there. And if we're going to do anything about it, then my responsibility as a writer is to tell of an incident as clearly as I can. The responsibility of someone else in the community is to do their job well. The responsibility of the politician, for example, is to not dissemble, but to speak straight from the heart. I'd much rather vote for somebody I could see who was clear to me as an individual than somebody who pretended that in a tight moment he might vote for what I believed was true. I don't want that. I mean, you can't live in a world where men and women have no integrity and expect to get anywhere or to save yourself, your family, or your country in difficult circumstances. And there, all that, well, the only thing I want to say to end it is all that comes out of standing on a beach watching your fellow human beings react to these dead whales.
Well, thank God you were on that beach. We have to clear the studio in about 12 minutes, and I did want to cover a few other things here. One of the most poignant essays was The Stone Horse. Tell me about The Stone Horse.
I was in Southern California working on a story for National Geographic about the California desert, and I try to do a lot of homework. And one of the things that I wanted to see, not necessarily write about, but one of the things that I wanted to see, I wanted to touch and focus on for a long time, was what is called an intaglio, or a stone glyph, a ground glyph, an arrangement of stones in two dimensions on the floor of the desert, usually in a fairly extensive arrangement of stones representing, say, an animal, that were built or constructed by people 300 or 400 years ago, prior to contact, probably. Some of these are known from the Nazca Plain, for example, in Peru, where these ground glyphs are so huge that they're incomprehensible unless you're, say, looking from the sky. So I wanted to find one of these ground glyphs and look at it and just spend time in its presence, and then I would have some way to think about it when I was writing the article, even if I never mentioned it in explicit terms. So I went to an archaeologist and I said, I would like to see something like this. Where should I go? And he said, the danger is so high, there's so few left, and the danger of vandalism is so high that I'm reluctant to tell you. And he got to know me a little bit, and he believed me when I told him that I would never reveal where this a ground glyph was if he would just help me find it so I could have that experience. And so he did, and that's what this story is about. It's about a stone horse that this man directed me to that was built 300 or 400 years ago.
By unknown people.
By unknown people. There's no way to find out who built it. And so I spent a long morning. I watched the sunrise over this ground glyph, and it brought to mind many things, that horses were here in North America, and then they were gone. And the next time the native peoples of North America saw them is when the horses returned with the Spaniards. But their ancestors would have hunted the horse as food. And now they see the horse again, and the horse has returned in concert with this peculiar human beings, these Spaniards who, you know, the beginning of the conquest of North America by European nations. I thought about how far back in time the horse goes with us, and the Hittite cavalry rode with horses 3,500 years ago. Outside of Xi'an in China, you can see the first Chinese emperor in his grave. There is a terracotta army of life-size horses buried there with him. All of which, by the way, and I can say this because I stood there with my binoculars and stared at every one of those horses that was exposed in that grave. Every one of those horses is different. Somebody took the trouble to make every horse distinct in that group of horses in China. So I was thinking about this. I was thinking about horses that part of my life when I was breaking horses in Wyoming and working with horses, making my living that way. And I tried to bring all of this human experience with horses to focus on this animal and to point out how perfectly observed this rendition was, the line of the belly, the line of the legs, the attitude of the horse. It was done by somebody who really understood what a horse was. So there's a kind of attention to detail, and part of the historical record is that human beings pay attention at this level. And I couldn't get rid of the thought that it was threatened. And that the reason for writing the essay was to celebrate this part of the human archaeological heritage, which is older than Spain, older than the cultures for which we have names, like the local Indians in that area, Mojave and Chimaweve and whatnot. It goes back a long way, and it's testament to something that human beings believe in. And it is imperiled by a small part of the population of North America, which for whom history is either wrong and needs to be corrected, or for whom history is of no importance. Those are exactly the kinds of statements that feed totalitarian regimes. And even in America, you have to be alert, I think, to that kind of thing. So it's just an essay in which a man went into the desert and found a horse and thought about it for a while and then came back and told a story about it. I mean, that's all I do.
Barry, in one of the essays, I think it was Yukon Charlie, you write that there are two types of landscapes, an exterior landscape and an interior landscape. What do you mean?
Well, the exterior landscape is, for example, outside the city, grass and the trees and the flowers and the animals, the movement of weather, the flocking of birds in different periods of time during the year, various ineffable qualities in the land that we don't have words for necessarily, but which we recognize either by their presence or by their absence. And there is an interior landscape, which I guess is easiest to understand by saying there's a set of emotions within us that are periodically highly organized and give us a sense of our self-worth and hope about our lives and sense of well-being, and sometimes they're in chaos. And I think that one of the ways that story or literature functions is to reconnect that interior landscape, which is subject to all kinds of decay and complexity, to the exterior landscape, which has a kind of, I don't want to put too much emphasis on this, but which has a kind of eternal order, an order that is beyond human manipulation. And one of the reasons people walk in the woods, or that we have a tradition of walking in the woods, is to put yourself back to rearrange yourself in such a way by contact with the woods that you feel better about yourself and your possibilities in the world. And to me, that's what story does. That is, if there is a therapeutic aspect to literature or to story, it is to make a connection between an exterior landscape that has a kind of power and spiritual dimension, I guess, about it. Make that part of your own life. And I think that happens when you read a good story, no matter what. And I don't mean a good story that all comes out right in the end, or that you deny that there's something dark about human life. A good story for an adult mind that has nothing dark in it, we know as a fairy tale. I mean, that's how we talk about it, you know. A real story has to say something about real human life, but put it together in such a way that the reader trusts it and walks away from it saying, in a sense, my interior landscape is more highly ordered. I feel better about myself in the world having come in contact with this story. And the writer's obligation on the other side is not just to report in a disinterested and passive way the nature of the landscape he or she encountered, but to report as fully as you can what was marvelous and mysterious about the place, as well as those things that you think you understood, and to do it with a language that is elegant enough and carefully enough arranged so that the reader is fully engaged. But I think often of the writer's obligation as working in that middle ground between the exterior landscape to which you apprentice yourself as a student, as a writer, and that interior landscape of the reader toward which, as a writer, you have a responsibility.
Have you been following this controversy over the Adirondack Park?
No.
No. There's a great fear that much of the Adirondack Park, which is in the ownership of private individuals, is going to be developed. Much of it is surrounded by state-owned land. It's the largest semi-wilderness area. It's larger than Yellowstone National Park.
Yes.
I mean, it's a vast area up there. And the state, in some instances, is trying to use its power of eminent domain. But some entrepreneurs have purchased thousands and thousands and thousands of acres of this property. And the state is having a difficult time in trying to figure out how to preserve it from overdevelopment. And this, of course, is a problem not just in New York State, but throughout the world. As our population continues to expand, it seems that we have an insatiable appetite to take over this land, which we don't need to do. I mean, I don't know that there's a necessity for developing the Adirondack, taking the wilderness away from it. Anyway, what are your thoughts about this?
Well, my first thought, I guess, is that democracy is an experiment. You know, when you turn around and look at what has come in the wake of the American and French revolutions, you see the growth of a certain kind of contention about ownership by individuals and by governments and what's best for the people. And these kinds of problems are increasingly evident because so much of what's at stake is the last stuff. And in a situation like the one you describe, I think a lot of people are wondering, why isn't it possible to develop and have something else? You know, there's always that frame of mind that says we should be able to have both things, and that is frustrated because so many things go up to vote that you would like to have settled the way Louis the 16th might have settled them or something like that. But I don't, you know, these kinds of problems are for local discussion, really. I mean, I would see them in a generic way and maybe add something from what I know about situations like this where I live, which is 3,000 miles removed from the Adirondacks. I think that the whole question of land ownership and public trust is one that we're extremely uncomfortable to examine, because to give you an example from my part of the country, there I think is a notion that is widespread in America that the cattle that you eat, that you buy in the supermarket, comes from beef cattle that are herded by cowboys in the wide open West. And my understanding is that something like 1 or 2% of the meat in the supermarkets comes from cattle on open ranges. All of that land, or most of it, is land that is owned by the federal government, and it is rented for a pittance by the people who run cattle on it. I know of a situation, if I remember these figures, where the land is so poor in its ability to support cattle that in one 750,000-acre allotment, a man is running 3,600 head of cattle. And what that tells you is there's not much there for cattle to eat. And a lot of those people consider themselves to be in the finest tradition of American independence and cowboys and all the rest of it. But the fact of the matter is that in the West, a lot of people call this welfare ranching. And it doesn't go over very well with those people when people in Washington say, well, you know, they're complaining because money is going to welfare mothers or something like that, and nobody's paying any attention to tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of acres that are being destroyed by a very small group of people running cattle on land that was never meant to support cattle, and in order to keep up the tradition of the American cowboy, which you have to say is one that in some sense has been manufactured by Hollywood and perpetuated by Hollywood and certain clothing designers. And, you know, I mean, cowboys, the history of the American West is a history that not very many people want to hear. What they want to hear is the history of something they love that they call the history of the American West. And America, if you go and travel in other countries, has a major problem because it's uncomfortable with its history. And what it does is create nostalgia or nostalgic imagery to replace historical images with. We're not comfortable at all about what happened to Native people in North America. We're not comfortable at all with what has happened to the Great Plains. There was a place where that was covered from border to border by perennial grasses, that underneath which there was a tremendous depth of soil, this rich breadbasket of America. And we replaced those perennial grasses with annuals like rye and corn and wheat. And when you replace perennials with annuals, you have to expose the ground in the rotation of crops. And when you expose the ground, the rains come and wash the soil away. So 90% of the soil that was there 150 years ago is washed down the Mississippi. And it has, because we decided our annuals were better than the natural perennials and never made any effort to discover perennial grasses that could produce grains for human consumption. We just brought everything that we had from the Tigris-Euphrates Valley 10,000 years ago and stuck it in Iowa. So I may have moved away a little bit from the question that you've asked, but I don't know personally what the answers to what the answer is in this Adirondack situation, but I would say generically that all of this stuff boils down to the same thing, and people have to recognize that we live in a world of limited resources, and that everyone knows in their guts that the highest calling is not to amass a financial fortune, and the financial fortunes of America have largely been built on the acquisition, the manipulation, and the distribution of natural resources. And those days are over. And if we have no concern at all for the psychological and physical fate of our children, then I suppose we can go on sucking it out of the ground until there's nothing left and leave the children with the bones. I don't want to see that happen.
I'd like to go on. We could go on talking all afternoon, but we're completely out of time. Many of these essays, very moving. It's a nice book. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Don.
Thank you.